Studio B Productions. Sports can be a real joke, and this is the punchline. It's the Jocularity Show, the train wreck where sports meets comedy head on. Now, here are your hosts, Rick Aaron and David Wilmer.
Welcome to the Jocularity Show. I'm Rick Aaron.
And I'm Dave Wilbur.
And coming up, we'll be talking Utah Jazz. We'll be talking college hoops and March Madness. And also what is going on with fans in college hoops. Another crazed fan came onto the court just recently in Santa Barbara. We will also be talking to Dustin Chapman, the mastermind of the Chappie Awards. If you know anything about Twitter here in the state of Utah, you know all about It's Chappie and his Chappie Awards. He's going to run down some of the winners of the 2014 Chappies. But first, we are honored to be joined by the chief investigative correspondent for Inside Edition's I-Team, ladies and gentlemen, Lisa Guerrero. Lisa, thanks for joining us on the Jocularity Show.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me, Rick.
Yeah, you can see Lisa on Inside Edition weekdays at 6:30 p.m. on ABC4 here in Utah. Elsewhere, as they say, check your local listings. Lisa, I would guess since we are a sports podcast, most of our listeners know you from your time on Monday Night Football and also on the anchor desk at the Best Damn Sports Show, period. But your involvement in sports goes way back. I remember a time in the 1980s when you were working the sidelines as a member of the LA Rams cheerleader squad. Tell us about that.
That is going way back. That is actually one of my favorite memories. As I kind of grew up, I joined the squad when I was 18 years old. So I was pretty young and had just graduated from high school, and a girlfriend of mine dared me to try out for the Rams cheerleaders. And back in the 80s, being an NFL cheerleader was a really big deal. You know, they had, they telecast the auditions live here locally in Los Angeles. And it was like a 2-week experience with all these dance cuts and interviews. And they started out with over 1,000 women, and they cut it down to 7 new rookies for the squad that year. And like I said, they televised it live on the local media. So it was a really big deal, and it was a great experience for me. I was on the squad for 4 years and still maintain my friendships with those women today that I met 30 years ago. So it was pretty amazing. I mean, I look back at that time as being pretty fun, but I also remember, you know, at that point, I loved sports. I grew up with a dad who was a big sports fan. And I remember cheering on the sideline for the Rams game and looking over at the sideline reporters that were actually working for the local stations. And I would say to the other girls, I want to do that someday. And of course, they laughed at me because all of the sports sideline reporters back then were all men. And, you know, there were no women doing sports on the sidelines 30 years ago. And, you know, my girlfriends would laugh at me and they'd say, yeah, sure, you want to be a sideline reporter someday. And I really did. I wanted to be a sportscaster and I wanted to actually be a writer. I thought I might be a beat writer for a newspaper or something. So it was interesting that, you know, a few years later, I actually did get to be a sportscaster, but on TV rather than in print. And but I'll never forget those days as a Rams cheerleader. It was pretty fun. That was the Eric Dickerson era, Chris Everett, the end of the Jack Youngblood era. So it was a good time to be a Rams fan here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, Lisa, I got to say, you made the right choice going the broadcast route, because I've seen a lot of beat writers for newspapers, and you don't look like a beat writer for a newspaper, let me say. Hey, let me ask you a question. How much Aquanet was used on average in that Embraceable Use cheerleader locker room, and did anyone ever asphyxiate from the fumes?
Yeah, you know what? Half a can per girl. And in that locker room, I am surprised nobody passed out. I mean, we had our heads flipped over and we were teasing our hair upside down and then flipping it back and spraying cans of that stuff. And, you know, the bigger the hair, the better.
That was the big hair era for sure.
Big hair, blonde hair. I mean, I'm Latina. I'm naturally brunette. And for some God knows why reason, I decided to bleach my hair blonde because it was the 80s and it was Orange County.
Sure.
And I had big blonde hair. I looked like a member of like Winger or something. I looked like an 80s hair band dude. It was bad.
So Lisa, this is Dave. Hi.
Hi, Dave.
So you made it to Monday Night Football on Sideline Reporter, and everybody was happy for you, and you were probably happy too. So how awesome of a job was that? Working Monday Night Football, sidelines, NFL, Super Bowl, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, it was brief, obviously. I was only there for one season, and it was interesting how it happened, because I had been a sportscaster in the Los Angeles market, as Rick knows, going back about a decade. And, you know, I had worked as a local reporter for CBS2 and for Fox 11 in Los Angeles, and then I worked for Fox Sports Net, and I did shows like Tough Man and Sports Geniuses and, of course, the Best Damn Sports Show, period, for a couple of years. And so by the time Monday Night Football came to me, I had already been a Southern California sports reporter for over 10 years. And I had been offered, in the past, I had been offered other sideline reporting jobs before that. And I had always turned them down, thinking, you know, that's not really my strength, doing 7-second injury updates. That's not where I see myself. I saw myself as more of a sports personality. And, you know, I wanted to be the Barbara Walters of sports. I wanted to do sit-down interviews with news-making athletes. I wanted to get into, you know, sports controversy, topic of the day. I didn't see myself at all as a sideline reporter. But when Monday Night Football comes to you and asks you to be the sideline reporter, you kind of say, okay, because it's the biggest and most important sports broadcast in the country. And so I kind of went against what my gut was telling me. Basically, my agent said, you're going to do it. And I just had a feeling it wasn't going to be the right fit for me, even though it was Monday Night Football, and to many people, that's a dream job. So I said, I'll do it. And you know, the agreement was, originally with ABC, was that they were going to let me be very feature-oriented, bring a lot of personality to the broadcast. It wasn't going to be an X's and O's, 7-second injury update type of job. Two questions at the end of the game with the player of the game. That wasn't what the job was going to be when they hired me. Well, about 2 weeks before we went to our first preseason game, ABC came to me and they said, guess what? We want you to just be straightforward, X's and O's. We want you to cut your hair. We want you to dress very conservatively. And we basically want you to be a prototypical female sideline reporter. And, you know, initially that wasn't what I wanted to do. And by that point, you know, I think it was like 10 days before our first game, it had already been announced I was part of the team. We had already done all this publicity. We'd shot the posters. You know, I was part of the team. So again, you know, I just had a feeling in my gut this wasn't going to be the right fit for me. And it wasn't. I just wasn't comfortable in the capacity of that job. And as you can tell by the way I'm going on, I'm pretty verbose. And I, you know, I found it really hard to condense the stories that I'd researched every week into a 15-second soundbite in between plays. And just, I wasn't comfortable with it. So although, you know, the job for many people would be a dream job, for me, it wasn't the right fit. And, you know, I'm glad that I had that opportunity. But as I look back, it, you know, I really regret saying yes to the job to begin with. And I was really hoping the job was going to turn into something else.
Lisa, that one season on the sidelines for Monday Night Football in 2003, what stands out to you? Is there a particular game or an interview or a moment?
I think, you know, that it was interesting, the progression of the games. The three preseason games I had were really, really great. I mean, I had a great time doing that job. I think I connected well with the audience, and they were technically pretty smooth. The first regular season game, I misspoke. I inverted a couple of guys' names, and I didn't realize that I said it until the words came out. And then I saw a player look at me, and I realized, oh my gosh, I just inverted the sentence.
Which happens to everyone. At some point or another.
And, you know, it happens to every broadcaster, happens to everybody doing live television. However, the spotlight was on me, and I was under such an enormous spotlight, and I definitely was being criticized even before the first game, people didn't, a lot of people in the media didn't like the fact that ABC hired me. They wanted to see, you know, somebody from ESPN or a more, I guess, seasoned sideline reporter get that job. So immediately when it was announced that I got the job, I just got slammed before I even said word one. So I think a lot of people were waiting for me to make a mistake. And unfortunately, I made a mistake on the first regular season game. And that gave everybody the opportunity to say, see, she doesn't know sports. She's an idiot. She's a model. And in fact, that was the most difficult of all of the games for me was the first regular season game. And, you know, looking back on it, I go back now and I look at the tape and I can see what I did. But at the time, it was so devastating because I knew this is it. This was the mistake that everybody was waiting for, and I gave it to them. And for the rest of the season, I was criticized. Then throughout the rest of the season, I started to get more comfortable with working with the producers in my ear in that way and grabbing the guys, you know, for halftime and end of the game. It just became a lot easier for me. And so the end of the game, the end of the season was a really memorable game. And if you'll remember, it was when Brett Favre had just lost his dad the day before the Monday Night Football game when Green Bay played in Oakland.
Right, and there was doubt whether he would play at all, considering his dad, Irv, had
Correct.
Just passed away.
Correct, and in fact, we didn't know until he ran out onto the field that he was even going to suit up. There was so much speculation about this game. It was really, you know, nobody knew what was going to happen. So not only does he play, he throws four touchdowns in the first half. He goes off. He has the game of his career up to that point. It was really an incredible and awesome sight to see. So here we go. And, you know, there had even been speculation before his dad died that he might not play in that game because he had broken his thumb and he had a bunch of knick-knack injuries going into that game. So the fact that he was playing in it, despite his injuries, despite losing his dad, shockingly, the day before, and then for him to perform like that was amazing on Monday Night Football, the final, you know, regular season game of the year. So, you know, my producer said to me during the game, well, surely, you know, the PR people are saying you're not going to get him. He's not going to say anything after the game. You're not going to get him at the end of the game. And I just sat there on that sideline, and I just waited and waited and waited until I caught eyes with him about 2 minutes to go in the game. And I just said, Brett, please, please talk to me. Just two questions, please. And he looked at me, and he just kind of nodded, and he said, okay, I'll do it. So I ran over to their PR person, and I said, Brett just said he would do the interview. And so I'm communicating that to the booth with Al and John, and I said, you know, in my walkie-talkie, I said, you know, Brett's going to do it. Brett's going to do the interview. And everybody was shocked because he had said before the game to his PR people, I'm going to play, but I'm not going to talk to anybody after the game. So I got him to talk, and then the moment was so incredible because he was very emotional. I said, you know, Brett, it's one thing to play with a broken thumb. It's another thing altogether to play with a broken heart. How were you able to perform like that the day after you lost your father? Boom. And then he went on this very emotional journey and answered in the most open and incredible way. And it was pretty amazing. It was heartbreaking. It was amazing. And it was powerful. So I'll never forget that moment. I mean, I'm a sports fan. I always will be a sports fan. And regardless of the issues that Brett Favre had later in his career in the last few years, you know, I just have so much respect for him, having seen him battle through what he did and then being able to talk afterwards and be articulate and be able to explain how he was able to play like that after having lost his dad.
Yeah, one of the great moments in Monday Night Football history, possibly even NFL history. I remember it vividly, and it was a great job you did with that interview. You mentioned that you worked at KCBS and KTTV in Los Angeles. You also worked at Sports Channel New England, and a lot of people remember you from your time on the anchor desk at the Best Damn Sports Show, period, back in 2001 to 2003. What was it like working with Tom Arnold and John Sally and DeMarco Farr and those guys?
You know, it was such a great experience. I mean, anybody that loves sports, can you imagine having the opportunity every day for 2 hours to just talk about sports and talk about the sports topic of the day with professional athletes that all, you know, because during the 2 years that I was there, which were the first 2 years of the show, it was you know, John Krupp, and it was Michael Irvin, and it was, John Sally, and these incredible, storied athletes that had all achieved so much. And to be able to talk to Michael Irvin, for example, about hockey, or to be able to talk to John Sally about tennis, and to have, these sports topics of the day, be bandied about by athletes from different sports, and then Tom Arnold. It was just, it hadn't been done before. Now I notice that every other show on cable sports tries to be the best damn sports show, period, those first 2 years. I think we had good chemistry. It was original. It was fun. It was kind of shocking. It was interesting to have Tom Arnold there because he was a comedian and he'd just say whatever came out of it. I mean, it was just incredible.
Always with a cigar in his hand, right?
Pardon me?
Tom always had the cigar in his hand. That's what I remember about it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it was, and we shot live, 2 hours in front of a live audience. And, it was just a big undertaking in terms of the production of it. And then it had quite a cult following right away. So it was really neat to be involved in it the first couple of years. I left for Monday Night Football immediately after that. I got an offer from them after my second season with Best Damn Sports Show. And I occasionally watched it after that. But, to me, I think the best cast, not just because I was in it, but I thought the best cast was, the cast with John Crook and Michael Irvin and John Sally and Tom Arnold, Chris Rose, and I thought that was the best cast.
Yeah, and it seemed like that show went on for another decade or so, always trying to recapture that initial spark it had with that cast, but with varying degrees of success.
I thought it was kind of disappointing towards the end, but it was, for the time, I'm so glad I was a part of it because it was an incredible opportunity and it was so much fun. I loved it.
I love the Best Damn Sports Show, period. I wish it would come back and be as good as it was the first two years it was there.
Well, if they would just give us a call and hire us, we would go do it. Rekindle the magic.
Exactly. I mean, we're all still around. We can still do that show.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Lisa, you married Scott Erickson in 2004. He had 15 Major League Baseball seasons with the Twins, the Orioles, the Mets, Rangers, Dodgers, the Yankees.
That guy was money.
He was money.
Yeah.
He threw a no-hitter versus the Brewers in 1994. How cool was that?
Very cool. Yeah, he had an incredible career. He, but if you need him, the weird thing about it is you'd never know. He doesn't wear his World Series ring.
Wow.
Our house isn't filled with memorabilia. We don't have one single jersey hanging anywhere in the house. He's just about as modest and low-key about his career as any athlete I've ever met. And if you go into an athlete's home, you can tell that guy's an athlete. They've got their jerseys hanging. They've got pictures of themselves, with their awards. They've got a replica of the World Series trophy somewhere that everybody can see it. Scott is the opposite of that, which is really interesting because he was such a fierce competitor. But, in real life, he's quite a modest guy. And now he just kind of wants to coach. He coached the last couple of years in the minor leagues for the Cleveland Indians. He's taking the year off now. We've got a business situation happening down in Mexico that he is overseeing, which is really cool. Has to do with Tiger Woods and a very cool golf course called Diamante. And then Scott wants to get back into coaching again next year. So I think he wants to stay in baseball and give back to the young guys because he loves the game. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, Scott was such a great pitcher. I remember I always had him on my fantasy teams because he always kind of flew under the radar. He wasn't the biggest name in the majors, and you could usually get a value draft for him, but he always provided consistent starts. And something that I didn't know until I looked it up, he was one of People Magazine's 50 Most Beautiful People of the Year in 2000. So there's not a framed copy of that issue anywhere in the house?
No, in fact, somebody at my bachelorette party gave me the copy of that magazine in a frame, and I brought it home from the bachelorette party, and he was so embarrassed. He's like, oh, that needs to go in the garage. You cannot hang that up. And I really wanted to put it up at least in the bathroom or something where nobody would see it but me, and he just wouldn't allow it. He was just so embarrassed. So, again, what World Series champion doesn't wear their World Series ring? It's crazy.
And I would have my ring on,
it would be
noticeable. Whenever I paid, I'd make sure it was showing
and
everything.
David won a trophy in Little League 20 years ago, and he brings it in every time we do the show and puts it right here in the studio. That's how proud
I remind everybody of that. Absolutely.
Hey, Lisa, we talked about your sports background, but you are quite an accomplished actress as well. You've done seemingly everything in TV and films. Seinfeld, The George Lopez Show, Southland. You played yourself in the film Moneyball. And you also had a very memorable stint on a soap. Let me play a clip for you really quickly.
Damn it. I need Cole. I can't just go on dreaming about him. But how far am I willing to go to get him?
The voice of Francesca Vargas of Sunset Beach.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, that was so much fun. Yeah, I was on a soap opera called Sunset Beach, and that was produced by Aaron Spelling. And that was a crazy story because at the time I was a sportscaster locally in L.A. on CBS2. And at the same time, I was auditioning as an actress because I didn't know if I was going to be able to do sports full time. So I was kind of had one foot in each world, one foot in sports, one foot in the acting world. And I got this opportunity to audition for Sunset Beach. I actually played in the audition a victim. And Aaron Spelling saw the video and he said, "This woman is no victim. She's a villainess." So they actually wrote a character specifically for me named Francesca Vargas, and she was a jewel thief and a home wrecker, and she was fantastic. So it was so much fun. So I got to be a villainess on a soap opera, and again, it's just I feel, well, I'm 50 now, and I look back and I've had a lot of different incredible jobs, and I feel a little blessed, but that was one of the best ones. It was really fun. Plus, I got to make out with hot guys every day. I mean, on a soap opera. It was fun.
Fringe benefit of the job. I'll tell you my Sunset Beach memory. Not that I watched the show, but I remember working with you at Fox 11 in Los Angeles. And I walked out of the office one day, said goodbye to you. I was going on a trip. You were still there. You were working. I said, "I'll see you when I get back." I went and I got on a plane and I flew to Paris. It was an all-night flight. We got in at dawn the next morning and I'm out of it. I'm jet lagged and everything else. And I finally get to my hotel room and I turn on my TV and I see you on my television, except you're speaking French. And I don't know what you're saying. And I stared at the TV for a good minute and a half, just wondering, okay, what is going on here? Where the hell am I? And why is Lisa speaking French to me? Because I had just seen you in the office like 17 hours earlier.
Well, Sunset Beach, weirdly, was the number one show in France, in England, in like crazy places, Turkey, Kosovo. The show is extremely popular overseas. And, you know, it was somewhat popular in the United States, but for some reason, they loved the characters. And my character, who was a real bad girl, the Europeans loved her. So it's funny because I went to Europe recently about, I would say, like 8 or 9 months ago, and I get recognized on the street to this day as Francesca. And, you know, that what a blessing that is. It's so funny, and it's a real kick. Scott thinks it's hilarious. We did a USO tour together years ago, and we were in a little airport. I think it was Kosovo, and a girl came running up to me, and she said, "Francesca, Francesca!" And he just couldn't get over that I was recognized in this small place in an airport from a soap opera. It was crazy.
Lisa, tell us a little bit about what you're doing now with Inside Edition and the iTeam. I follow your exploits on Twitter. You can follow her at the number four, Lisa Guerrero. It seems like you're always flying to some place and busting some bad guy on camera.
Yeah. So my career has taken a crazy twist over the last few years. I was working for Inside Edition doing entertainment news and breaking news, and I begged my executive producer to do investigations. And he said, "No, it's very dangerous. It requires a lot of travel. It's grueling, and, you know, quite frankly, not a lot of women at the national level do this kind of journalism because you literally will have to chase after bad guys, and it's extremely dangerous." And I just begged and begged, and finally they kind of tested me out, and it was successful, and They could tell that I was really aggressive. And I think my sports background helped me so much with this job, because when you've been the only woman in a locker room, like I was 90% of the time, you just learn to be really aggressive. And, you know, when you're in a Lakers locker room and you need a Shaq spike, you were going to go get it. And I would kick and scratch and claw until I got my sound bites in the locker room. And I really had, based on that, I think a very fierce and tough sense of, you know, how I wanted to be as a reporter. And I'm just very aggressive. And so to me now, as an investigative journalist, it's fantastic, because what person doesn't want to be handed a microphone and have somebody go, here, that's a bad guy, he just killed somebody, or he just ripped off an old lady, or he's a, you know, a pedophile, and this guy's a crooked politician, here's all the information, go get him. I mean, it's such an incredible, empowering job for anybody, but especially for a woman. And so I've been doing that a few years, I love it. You know, I don't know how much longer I'm going to do it. I've got some other opportunities happening, but I've really enjoyed working at Inside Edition in the last several years. You know, I would like to continue to do investigations, because I think I'm really good at it. And at the end of the night, I go home and I say, you know what, I did something really good today. I exposed somebody's wrongdoing to an audience of 5 million people today, and that feels good. And I think, you know, as much as I love doing sports, as much as I love doing entertainment, doing investigations makes me feel like I'm doing something important.
Lisa, being a woman in sports, are there locker room issues? How has it changed? How has it evolved? And I believe you'd made Dennis Rodman cry once.
Yeah. That's another situation that happened early in my career. Dennis was doing a press conference in L.A. to basically to announce whether or not he was going to sign with the Lakers. And so he calls a press conference. I think it was at Planet Hollywood or some cheesy place. And so all of the press shows up, and we're waiting for Dennis. And then Dennis rolls in about an hour late, and he smells like vodka, and he's got Carmen Electra with him. And he basically said he didn't have an announcement, but he just wanted to see if we'd all show up. And it was, I think, my second week on the job for CBS2. And I just stood up and I started not yelling at him, but demanding to know why he would waste our time. And I said, you know, you're selfish. You're a selfish athlete. How dare you keep it? We all have jobs to do. We all have deadlines. How dare you waste our time like this? And I was furious. And everybody in that press conference was stunned. They didn't know who I was. Here I am, this girl. I probably look like an Entertainment Tonight reporter. I had a little pink jacket on. And here I am yelling at Dennis Rodman. And he was shocked. And he looked at me. And he said, listen, honey, I'm not selfish. And then he just started to cry. And it was carried live on ESPN. And it was also carried live locally. And after he stormed off the stage, everybody came up to me and asked if this was set up, if I was an actress, and if we had set it up. And I said, no, I've just been hired by CBS, too. And he just, it frustrated me, because I need to bring home a story, and I don't have a story. And all of the reporters, the veteran reporters, said, oh, yes, you have a story now, honey.
Yeah, you do now.
And it ended up that I was part of the story. Sports Illustrated did a story about me doing that, and it kind of launched my career. I really have Dennis Rodman to thank in many ways, because of his ridiculous behavior. It introduced me to the LA sports scene.
Now, ironically, 20 years later, your career is better than ever, and Dennis doesn't exactly have one anymore. But getting back to the first part of Dave's question, is it ever kind of uncomfortable being a woman covering primarily men's sports, going into men's locker rooms? Because I've been there before when there have been female reporters, and while they're always consummate professionals, and most of the athletes act professionally too, there is a kind of a sense of unease. What's your experience been like?
Well, when I first went into locker rooms 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, there weren't very many women covering sports. And I covered not only the pro sports in Los Angeles, but also college sports. So I was a beat reporter for UCLA and USC. And, you know, I think having me in the locker room for them was was kind of surprising and shocking and uncomfortable for them. It was certainly uncomfortable for me, but I had the respect of the coaches and the managers, and it was very clear that I was in the locker room only to do my job as quickly as possible, meaning I needed to go in and get a couple of sound bites very quickly.
Efficiently,
from
right.
Game or a couple of key players and then get out. So I was, you know, I was really lucky, I think. I wasn't abused in the locker room. I had maybe two, out of all the years I did sports, I had maybe two or three uncomfortable encounters or exchanges. But most of the time, the players and the coaches were very good to me because they knew that I didn't want to hang out there. I just needed to be there to get my sound and to get out. And you know, as time went on, I just kind of earned their respect. And by the time, you know, later in my career, when I was going into locker rooms, they were like, okay, what do you need, Lisa? And then, you know, in and out, easy. Nobody's uncomfortable. But at first it was strange. Now I look at it. I mean, it's such a different landscape now. There are so many females covering sports. There are so many women in the locker room. I think some are better than others. Some are great. Some aren't great. And, you know, I think, you know, for me, I'm glad I was there when I was, being one of the first ones in LA to cover. But, you know, I'm sure it must be much easier now for the women because there are just so many of them.
Yeah, because of pioneers like you. Lisa, I want to ask you about an interesting career choice you made back in, I guess it was around 2005. Now, when it comes to Playboy magazine, Dave has issues, lots and lots of issues. But after years of Playboy kind of pursuing you and making you offers, you chose to pose for them, and you have a photo spread in the January 2006 edition. Why did you make that choice, and what have been the effects of it on your career?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like you said, they had approached me actually 20 years prior to that when I was just modeling, and they asked me to be a playmate. And I said, well, of course not. I would never take off my clothes for a magazine. I'm not, you know, I turned them down. And every couple of years, they came back to me to, you know, continue to offer me at first to be a Playmate of the Month. And then later, as I became more well-known, they started offering me the cover, the celebrity covers. And I, you know, I kept saying, no, 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 I'm not going to do it. Well, 20 years later, they came to me again. But the difference was, when they came to me the last time, I had just gotten married to Scott, and I knew I was leaving sports, and I wanted to get a job on an entertainment magazine or hosting an entertainment show. I wanted to do something different, but, you know, people just knew me as a sportscaster. So Scott said, you know, why don't you do it? You know, if you want to do it, do it. Someday you're going to be, you know, 80, 90 years old. You look fantastic. You know, it's iconic. And he goes, you're married, it's safe, you can do it if you want to. If you don't want to do it, don't do it. But if you want to do it, you can do it. Have fun with it. Go for it. And I hadn't thought of it like that. And when I talked to my agents about it and talked to my family, and I said that my goal is to get on an entertainment show. And maybe the publicity of me doing this will help with that. So I took a huge risk, and it's a risk I would not ever recommend to somebody early in their career. I did Playboy when I was 40, and I had already finished doing sports. I would not do that early in my career, and in fact, I had opportunities to, and I passed. But at that point, I just took a huge risk. It could have backfired terribly. Instead, what happened was I got a ton of publicity because it was very shocking for a lot of people. It was very controversial that I did it, and I ended up getting a lot of interviews and a lot of publicity because of it. One of the shows that did a story about me appearing on the cover was Inside Edition. And when their executive producer saw the interview that their reporter did with me, he said, wow, she's great on camera. She's so articulate. She's really bubbly. I'm going to give her an offer. So I ended up getting an offer from Inside Edition as a reporter for 2 years. And that 2-year contract has turned into an 8-year contract. And a great relationship and a huge rebranding of my career as, you know, at first an entertainment reporter and now an investigative reporter. But that never would have happened had I not done Playboy. But it could have been a disaster. It could have gone the other way. But, you know, thankfully for me, within 48 hours of that magazine coming out, I had a 2-year contract from Inside Edition. So it worked.
Well, that's fantastic. Your husband, Scott, was supportive of you. And, you know, I guess 40 is the new 20, and you were able to reinvent your career, and that success continues on to this day. Hey, Lisa, thanks very much for spending some time with us here on the Jocularity Show.
Hey, thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. And just one quick note, I'm actually writing a book about my career, and it's called Between a Jock and a Hard Place. And I hope when the book comes out next year, you'll have me back, because I'd like to talk about books in the process of writing a book about being a woman in sports and then rebranding myself and doing the other fun things I get to do now.
Absolutely. Between a Jock and a Hard Place, we will look forward to that, and we will talk to you when that comes out. Thanks again.
Thanks, guys.
Time to scratch the surface on the topics that get under your skin. Get ready for Jock Issues.
And Dave, you know what? Now that I think about the short history of the Jocularity Show, we are in our infancy here. We're only a month old now. I mean, we're still waking up in the middle of the night crying. I don't know about you, but I am. But I believe that's the first time that we've had a guest on the show who has appeared nude in the pages of Playboy.
It's probably the first time the guest has appeared on a Utah podcast or radio or TV show that's appeared in Playboy.
I don't think Craig Bowlerjack was ever in Playboy, or Mike Runge or Ron McBride or Randy Cardoon for that matter. So yeah, I'm pretty sure that's a first for us. But getting into our Jock Issues today, issue number one, the Utah Jazz. If they have not hit rock bottom, they are darn close to it. This six-game road trip has turned into a trail of tears. They have been a disaster, getting blown out at Cleveland, narrowly losing at Indiana, and then getting destroyed by the worst team in the NBA, the Milwaukee Bucks. Dave, what's going on with this Jazz team?
The Jazz are making the Milwaukee Bucks look like the 1997 Chicago Bulls. Good night.
A team that had won 11 games all season long going into that one. You think, okay, if there is one game on this six-game East Coast road trip that the Jazz could win, it would be in Milwaukee against a horrid Bucks team. And then they just go out there and get destroyed. And it was another one of those nights where it looked like the Jazz would rather be somewhere else. Like their minds were on a beach somewhere.
Right. You say another one of those nights, because it does happen often that we notice this, that it looks like they're not there mentally 100%.
Yeah, and it's funny. I tweeted you during the game. I said, because David is not a big Tyrone Corbin fan. I said, David is really looking forward to hearing Coach Corbin's post-game comments after this one. And you said something to the effect of,
well, just go watch the first one of the regular season, and you get your post-game comments throughout the whole season. They're all the same. Let's get better. We just have some things to work on. We'll get there eventually. We just need to work harder, and we'll get there.
Well, one thing that Coach Corbin says time and time again that I've noticed is we've got to get better. And I agree with them, Coach. You do have to get better, because you can't get much worse at this point. I mean, this is a team, obviously, with some ability. They've won some games this season after that horrendous 1-14 start. They put together a couple of quality wins and actually a couple of decent stretches, you know, three or four games at a time. But it seems like not making any moves at the trade deadline was kind of a white flag. And the players have kind of just bought into this culture of losing. And, you know, who cares if we get blown out at Cleveland, if we get destroyed at Milwaukee? Yeah.
But this is a team that beat the Miami Heat.
And the Oklahoma City Thunder.
Right. They beat the best teams in the league and then lose by a million to the worst teams in the league. And now my own opinion is Tyrone Corbin is not coming back as the head coach of the Utah Jazz next year. Gordon Hayward is not going to be returning to the Utah Jazz next year. You're going to have multiple personnel changes. The entire coaching staff may be wiped clean, and these players know that. And so what are they playing for? It's basically their next contract. Gordon Hayward, man, he's having a horrible year for a contract year, in my opinion.
Yeah, and the sad thing for fans here, and everybody's been talking about tanking and draft positioning and all the great talent that's available in the draft, but the last third of this season is just going to be playing out the string and just trying out some different people at different positions, trying out some younger guys, seeing what they can do. Some of these guys are going to be auditioning for their future at the Jazz. Some are going to be playing for their lifeline in the NBA just to hang around this league.
Right.
But,
yep.
You know, it's just, I would have liked to seen them kind of carry the momentum from the middle of the season when they were playing kind of decently in parts of December and January and kind of putting up a fight. But it looks like they are just happy to lay down in the middle of the road and play speed bump for the rest of the teams in the NBA the rest of the way on out. Issue number two, College Hoops. It is March, and that means March Madness. And for a while here in the state of Utah, it was looking like a pretty dismal basketball season. The Utes weren't doing very much early on in the Pac-12 season. BYU had some horrible losses in the WCC season. And now, as we get ready to start the conference tournaments, as we record this, BYU could very well win out on their conference tournament down in Las Vegas. They might be a bubble team even if they don't win out and might still get into the tournament. They've been playing a lot better as of late. Utah with some good wins in the conference. They've got at least a puncher's chance in the Pac-12 tourney down in Vegas. And Weber State is going to be hosting their conference tournament, the Big Sky tournament. So basically all they have to do is win two games on their home floor to get into the big dance.
Which sometimes is tough for Weber State to do.
We've seen something always happens in that situation.
And it's always at the last second of the game that knocks them out too. Oh, there's been some heartbreakers up there in Ogden. Oh man, Utah. In my own opinion, the Utes need to win the Pac-12 tournament to guarantee their slot into the NCAA tournament. Even just the showing in the final game, I don't even think puts them on the bubble. I think they absolutely have to win. For Brigham Young to go to the NCAA tournament, I think they just need to show up to the final game of the WCC tournament. They just need to go to the game.
Maybe not even then. I mean, most bracketologists, and there's a million of them out there these days, have BYU in the tournament as it stands right now. I mean, unless they did something really bad to damage that resume. But we are looking at the possibility of having two teams from the state, possibly three teams from the state, get into the big dance, which would be a lot of fun. Now, Utah State is having an off year up at Logan. Usually they're perennial contenders in their conference. This year in the Mountain West, not so much, and I don't see them making any kind of a run in their conference tournament.
But, I don't either.
But BYU and Weber could certainly be in the big dance, and as I said, Utah, the way they've played as of late, they've at least got a puncher's chance. They've got a shot to beat anybody they go up against down in Vegas.
No, you're right, Rick. Utah has a shot to get into the NCAA tournament this year. I mean, even last year, they went to the Pac-12 tournament championship game. They did lose, and they were a horrible team. Nobody thought they were going to make it out.
Well, a much worse team than they are this year.
Absolutely, yeah. This year, they've got 20-plus wins, and they have a fantastic team that can probably get them back to the Pac-12 tournament. And depending on who they face up in that championship game, they have a chance to win and to go to the NCAA tournament. Now, we're getting excited because they have a chance. They're already in the NIT, in my opinion. And how fantastic is that after some horrible years of basketball up on the hill? Now they're in the NIT.
Well,
that's fantastic.
Boylan gets fired. Everybody leaves, basically. It's mass defections. And then, you know, Kraskowiak comes in, basically has to cobble together a roster of whoever he could convince into coming here and playing for him in the early years. And they've made great strides since then. It has been a bizarre season in college basketball. We saw the Marcus Smart push comes to shove incident with a fan at Texas Tech. Yep. And we saw the brawl at the mall between New Mexico State and Utah Valley University, where the fans rushed the floor and it got out of hand, got in some confrontations with the Aggie players. And now, just recently, some kid runs out of the stands at UC Santa Barbara and confronts Hawaii head coach Gib Arnold. What is this kid thinking? He looked like a scrawny little punk. He couldn't have been 135 pounds soaking wet. And he sprints out of the stands and takes an aggressive stance, basically gets in the face of Coach Arnold, has to be pushed away by some Hawaii players. What is going on?
Wow, there was no security on that court whatsoever.
No, there was security, but they were standing and watching.
Exactly. Nobody stopped this kid. He's like, what, 7-9 rows up in the stands.
And comes sprinting down, made a beeline.
Goes over to the court, runs over to the coach, and just gets in his face and starts yelling some pretty bad stuff at him because it's blurred out now. and then he goes back to his seat, and nobody's even getting him at that point. He's halfway up to his seat. He's high-fiving fans. And no security guards has even gotten to him. You would think after what happened at Utah Valley last week that there would be a little bit more security, maybe at least one or two more guys to watch the fans.
Well, we've always had the phenomenon of streakers and the occasional lone idiot who wants to run onto the field or run on the court and make a spectacle of himself. But I don't know what is going on in society in general now, if it's the influence of video games, if it's rampant narcissism, or everybody thinks they have a right – to be a part of the event, not just to go and sit and watch it and cheer or boo, but to actually get involved. And this guy didn't like a call involving a technical foul or something. So he just decided, hey, I'm Joe Blow Gaucho student. I'm going to go down there and have a word myself. Like, and I tell you, I think what the problem is, it's headbands. No, seriously.
Here we go.
What was the main instigator in the Utah Valley Brawl wearing?
Headband guy.
Yeah. He looked like Loverboy from the 80s. And then what was the kid wearing at UCSB?
Oh, he had himself a good headband as well.
Yeah. It's constricting blood flow to the brain, people. Take off the stupid headbands.
Time to hear what you're saying in 140 characters or less. A little bird tells us these are the tweets of the week.
And here in Utah, it is all about the 2014 Chappie Awards on Twitter, the hashtag 2014 Chappies. And joining us on the phone is the man behind the Chappies, Dustin Chapman. Dustin, how you doing?
Doing great. How are you guys doing?
Hey, we're doing fantastic. So just give us a little bit of a background, maybe for some of our listeners who don't follow the Chappie Awards. How did this come about and when?
It came about in 2012. Back in the infancy, as it were, of Twitter, way back 2 years ago, we used to have the tradition of Follow Fridays, and I would do that, but I didn't like just the, the traditional Follow Friday, here's a list of people. That's I always like to tell stories, why you should be following this person. And after doing that for a while, one day I was, we were talking about Follow Friday, and I said, we don't need it, let's just do a big end-all, be-all of Follow Fridays, and we'll call it the Chappies, and that's how it was born.
And it took off from there.
All great ideas, that's just stupid.
No, it is a great idea. I love it. It gets a lot of people involved, a lot of people around the nation, actually. I think it was trending nationally at one point today, I believe it was. And I won an award today, so that's why I'm even more excited. I have a Chappie to hang up on my wall, so thank you so much for that, Dustin.
Yeah,
my pleasure. You weren't voted Rick.
Well, yeah, I did. I won a Chappie award as well. I guess I got best hashtags for some of my creative Utah bands and Utah reality shows, Utah
fantastic
movies. And Dave, you were on for what? Best Ute fan on Twitter?
I got awarded best under the radar Ute tweet is what I got.
So we are both proud recipients, and we appreciate that. Has it surprised you how this has taken off? Because I remember last year, 2013, the Deseret News got involved, ran an article. All the local media, radio shows were jumping on it, and you became kind of a local celebrity for organizing this. Have you been surprised at how much attention it's received?
Yeah, it blows me away every year. I mean, I get tweets throughout the year, people telling me that something deserves a Chappie. I mean, it happens weekly, if not more throughout the year. And then, when it gets time to do it, it blows me away. It's amazing how I call it a fake little award show, but I guess it's not that anymore. It's amazing how a random thing like that's taken off.
Yeah. How many hours do you say you spend a week getting the Chappies ready to go?
Throughout the year, it's taken a lot of time over the past 2 weeks, but throughout the year, I have a running document on Google Docs that I just update whenever I see things on Twitter, even if a lot of them don't even turn into awards, but they just, they're random thoughts and random, just thoughts and everything like that, they come together and make an award show at the end of the day.
So, Dustin, how do you think that your pre-show Chappie Awards host did today? That would be me. At Rick Aaron.
The pre-show was the highlight of the show. I want to thank you for doing that, Rick.
No problem. It was fun. I think it kind of underscores this event is kind of a microcosm of Twitter itself, which is it's a great way to bring together a lot of people from different areas and different backgrounds and different interests, because you've got followers that are BYU fans, that are Utah fans, that are RSL fans, USU, Weber State, fans of some of the television shows that you watch and tweet about. And it kind of brings together this community of people who have never met before and never will meet in real life, but yet are great friends through this social media.
It's beautiful in a way. I mean, I've thought about Twitter over the years, which I shouldn't be thinking about, but to me, like you said, there's the whole concept of circles, you know, and people in a local area form different circles, and then there's some circles of that, like you said, with Weber State, with RSL, with University of Utah, BYU, Utah State, and all these sub-circles overlap a little bit, you know, and you're right, they do form a nice community of people that really, in life, probably don't have a whole lot in common, but in reality, they do, and they get to meet and chat on Twitter and find out that people are people.
Now, in terms of our own selfish interests, you did have a category. It was voted on by the fans. It was Best Utah Podcast, and the Jocularity Show did not win, and hey, that's okay.
We took second, so we were the first loser.
Yeah, we were the runners-up in that voting, but who was the winner of that one?
Cougar Center. BYU guys from Lawless Republic. There was a lot of votes on that. I think there were, last time I checked, there were 350 or 400 votes on that category, and that's amazing. I didn't expect to see that in my open voting.
Dustin, who are some of the other big winners today? If you can recap the Chappies, or should I say rechap the Chappies?
Well, the big winner, the best tweet on my timeline was Uncle Pooh. He's great.
Yeah, at Big Uncle Pooh. He's a BYU fan, kind of a non-traditional BYU fan in terms of his lifestyle, but a great tailgater and a great guy.
A great follow on Twitter as well.
Oh, he's hilarious. And you know, something about, like you said, he's a non-traditional BYU fan, but he's respectful. And he's a good guy. He's funny.
He will take his shirt off and send out some topless selfies from time to time. Just a warning if you're thinking about following him. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
I like those.
Who else got your best media members for the different teams they cover?
Well, the best media member overall was Ben Winslow, as it has been since the awards have started. KSL won the award for best overall presence on Twitter. I mean, they're a huge conglomerate. They have a lot of ways to do it, but they do it right. And it's been fun to see, you know, KSL grab onto it, Channel 2 grabbed onto it now. Channel 4 is really coming up there. They're all starting to get into it. It's great for media people because I said this about you before, Rick. It's in a 2-minute sportscast, we don't get to see how truly hilarious you are.
Well, unfortunately, in a 60-minute podcast, you don't get to see how truly hilarious I am either. But no, I appreciate you saying that. No, it's funny that it took me leaving my position as sports director at Fox 13 to really embrace Twitter. First of all, to be able to tweet what I wanted, stupid jokes, sports commentary, things like that, as opposed to just station promos, which I was limited to when it was a work account. But you're right. It's a way for me to connect with an audience, with my viewers and former viewers, and have conversations back and forth. Because as you know, if somebody tweets at me, I'll tweet right back at them, and we have some good engaging conversations on there. Hey, Dustin, congratulations on the huge success of the 2014 Chappie Awards. We'll hope that this podcast gets nominated for a 2015 Chappie and makes the ballot next year, and maybe some of these losers out there can get on their computer and vote for us, and we can bump Cougar Center off of the top spot. What do you think?
That sounds like a great idea.
Dustin Chapman joining us here on the Jocularity Show. You can follow him on Twitter at It's Chappie is his name. I believe his Avi is currently a character from the Walking Dead series. Anybody who is anyone in the state of Utah follows Chappie on Twitter. Thanks for joining us on the Jocularity Show.
My pleasure. You know, again, Rick, thank you for doing the pre-show this morning. It works so well because Twitter is, the award show works so well because it's kind of like radio. It's a little bit of a theater of the mind. And you have people going really, really good this morning. I appreciate it.
Well, it was fun to be involved with it, and it was fun being involved in this edition of the Jocularity Show. For David Wilbur, Dustin Chapman, our producer, Alan Martindale, and of course, Lisa Guerrero, I am Rick Aaron, and I will see you later.
For show information, go to our website, jocularityshow.com. You can email us at jocularityshow@tornbysports.com and follow us on Twitter at jocularityshow.